BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. This is podcast number 176, and today is Wednesday, July 25th, 2012. I need to start off the podcast today with an apology and an explanation about yesterday. I had, for new listeners, a quick disclaimer. I've had over 35 concussions in my life. I have been knocked unconscious more than 25 times. And when I say more than, it's considerably more than. Those are times that are absolutely verifiable, that I remember all the circumstances involving them. And, I don't count times when I was knocked unconscious or had a concussion that I have no memory of, or other events like that where I can't specifically put a specific set of circumstances around it. So, because of that, I have some rather unusual health issues. In addition to things like really bad arthritis from having a truck fall on me, and other things like that. So, because of the repeated head injuries, sometimes I have days or even weeks where things are a little difficult. And I've been building up here lately. Things have been getting behind, things like being able to keep up on the email and do some of the routine things that I am supposed to do around the house and in my day-to-day life. I haven't been able to keep up with them. And this came to a head yesterday. came to a head yesterday when I really had a rough day and just was not capable of doing much of anything. So that's my excuse for not having a podcast yesterday. So we just threw together an old one, and hopefully that didn't upset anyone's schedule too badly. But I'm back. I'm, not 100%, but I'm back today. And so that's my excuse for taking a day off. So, considering you people are kind of like my employers, even though, I don't get paid for this or anything, but still, I work for, my listeners in that sense. So I'm not asking for sympathy by telling you about my medical problems. I'm just giving an explanation of why I took a day off work. And, it's kind of one of those things where, like, you take a day off work and then your employer sees you at the park, feeding the ducks or whatever. It's like, you didn't look sick to me. Well, dude, I was sick. I wasn't sick in the way of, having a fever or something. But I definitely needed to sit around and feed the ducks for a day. So, okay, so that's my excuse to my boss there. I want to also remind everybody that on Saturday, August 18th, 2012, at noon, the Raw Milk Freedom Riders and the Lemonade Freedom Day are having a picnic in celebration of Freedom of Voluntary Exchange. And so if you can get to 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson near the Capitol Reflecting Pool in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, August 18th, 2012, around noon, be sure and get over there. Take some food to share and expect to have some fun. If you have a camera, bring a camera. And if the government sends in goons, then be sure and film as much as you can. So, again, that's August 18th, noon, at the near the Capitol Reflecting Pool in Washington, D.C. Again, I haven't been able to keep up with my emails. If you have emailed me, please be patient. In the next, in the days ahead, I'm going to try to get back in there and get caught up. I've just been overwhelmed lately, and I'll get back to the emails as quickly as I can. In the meantime, I wanted to touch on a topic that I've heard some people talking about, and I thought I should just cover it. I've touched on this a little bit before, but I think I should clarify some things just to make sure. So the topic that I'm talking about is animal rights. Not just animal rights. Animal rights and how that relates to the zero aggression principle. I was listening to someone talking about whether or not it was right, how the zero aggression principle applies when considering like animal cruelty, whether or not you should, you know, actually eat animals, if you should kill and eat animals. And I think there's a lot of confusion on this topic. And I think, you know, I don't know how to say this without sounding like a conspiracy nut, but I think a lot of it is intentional. I think a lot of the confusion is intentional because I think there are people who stand to make a lot of money on animal rights issues and on vegetarian issues, and those people intentionally fog the discussion. I think the only way you can really wrap your head around this topic, correctly, is if you blot out everybody who's looking to make a dollar on it, and think, you know, really think it through for yourself. Now, the way I look at this, I've talked before about how I spend a lot of time watching different animals, specifically, yard animals like squirrels and birds and animals that a person sees around a normal suburban yard. And I've come to a series of conclusions. And one of those is that every animal has certain rights, but those rights are unique and specific to that animal species. So, for example, I've talked before about how if you watch birds like sparrows and wrens, capital punishment is a very natural part of the sparrows' social interactions. You'll have a flock of sparrows that live. In my case, I have a large set of hedges, and I feed the sparrows quite a bit, and so they live year round in my hedges. And they come out, and some of them are pretty friendly. I can be sitting, outside on the driveway or whatever, and they'll actually come and just land almost right next to me, waiting for me to throw out some food for them. So I've watched the sparrows a lot, and I've learned quite a bit from this little flock of sparrows. And what I found out is that they have a very tight society where the slightest infraction of their rules will bring the whole flock down on an individual sparrow, and they will assassinate it. They will not assassinate. It's capital murder. They kill it. They will kill one of their own sparrows if there's an infraction worthy of that. And it seems, by watching the sparrows, it seems that it doesn't take much of an infraction to bring about the death penalty. And my assumption in this is that it's critical for their species to have that level of discipline. It's critical for their species to not allow infractions because, for instance, with the sparrows, an infraction can mean somebody's not standing guard correctly and a cat gets into the hedge, and you can have a far bigger problem than, for the flock of sparrows, because a regular house cat doesn't necessarily kill the sparrows for food. House cats that roam around in neighborhoods kill primarily for entertainment, for the sport of it. So if the sparrows are not following their rules, it can have deadly results for the whole flock. So for this reason, the sparrows are aggressive about this. But at the same time, I watch other birds, like, for instance, I've talked before about the blue jays, and the blue jays are very aggressive with each other, and they have a very complex society that they work under a very specific set of rules that their flock works under. And I might say the blue jays flock entirely different than the sparrows. The sparrows all stay in one hedge together, and they go out from there separately. But but when one of them finds food, they come back and tell the others, and then they all come and get that. The blue jays are different. The blue jays stay spread out over a large area. Like in my case, you know, probably over the flock of blue jays that I feed and deal with here, probably control an area of about maybe 50 acres or so within this neighborhood, and they have what appears to be a very loose knit flock, but in fact it's highly disciplined, and there are very set rules that and there's a hierarchy within the blue jays that you can observe. Now, the difference between the blue jays and the sparrows is, though, that the blue jays will never, ever gang up and attack another blue jay. They follow the rules of their flock without any physical punishment for breaking those rules. Their punishment is, it appears to me, that their punishment is to isolate a blue jay that doesn't, you know, they shun it. That's their form of punishment. I have never, in all the years that I've watched the Blue Jays, I have never seen Blue Jays gang up and attack a single Blue Jay. It just never happens. Now, here we have two different species of birds, and there are specific natural laws that apply to the Blue Jays that do not apply to the sparrows. And there are specific natural laws and specific rights that go with those laws that apply to the sparrows that do not at all apply to the blue jays. And an example of that is capital punishment. The sparrows, capital punishment is common. And the blue jays, capital punishment does not exist. Therefore, capital punishment is against natural laws for blue jays. But capital punishment is within natural laws for sparrows. You see, two different species with their own versions of property rights, their own version of liberty, their own version of what is and what isn't natural rights to each one of those two species. You can make the same argument by, you know, I was talking about squirrels. You can make the same argument about squirrels. Squirrels, if you watch them when these are the large gray squirrels that we have here in this part of Ohio. You watch the squirrels as they interact with each other. And the only time two squirrels will actually make physical contact when they're out, they're down away from a tree, or they're out feeding in the yard, or even playing on the side of a tree or whatever. They will make physical contact if they're playing with each other, if there's mating involved, or if there's a confrontation over food. They will make physical contact. They rarely actually fight because they are so well equipped for a fight that they rarely actually fight. They have conflicts, but they settle them with shoving and a quick impact from one to the other, and then the thing is settled. But you never see all the squirrels gang up and kill one squirrel. You just don't see this. The squirrel, that's capital punishment, is not a part of the gray squirrels' society. Now, that doesn't mean that the capital punishment that the sparrows do is wrong. How can it be wrong? It's natural to them. So you can't judge the capital punishment that the sparrows are doing and say, well, those are evil sparrows for killing one of their fellow sparrows. You can't do that because you're not judging them according to their species. You're judging them according to what you think. And you're not a sparrow. All right, now let's take this to veganism, and let's take this to animal rights, and let's take this to animal cruelty and so forth. The zero aggression principle is a human natural law. It's not, you can't apply the zero aggression principle to lions. You can't apply the zero aggression principle to snakes. It's entirely illogical because those are not people. The zero aggression principle is a human principle. It's a human law. It's a human natural right and a human natural law. To apply it to, you know, to jellyfish would make no sense whatsoever. And this is what you have when you're thinking of the zero aggression principle. You have to realize now we're talking about human rights and human laws and human natural laws, and to apply those to animals other than humans is illogical. So then, is there a moral case for a vegan? There may be. I think I can make a pretty. I'm not a vegan. I'm not a vegetarian. I love meat. I eat anything that doesn't eat me first. You know, I'm not particular at all. But I can probably make a pretty good moral argument using biblical references for why vegetarianism is probably a good idea. I can also make a pretty good argument using practical means to say why vegetarianism is probably not good. Things like the fact that if you look at our teeth, we have molars, we have incisors, we have canines. That means it's a variety of chewing types and styles. That means clearly we are opportunists. We'll eat anything that we can to survive. That means bugs, that means leaves, that means nuts, that means, you know, crushing bones, whatever it takes. Our teeth are, you know, if you look at vegetarian teeth, they're typically either, designed for cracking nuts, or they're designed for eating leaves or grass or whatever. We don't have the digestive tract that vegetarian animals have. We don't have multiple chambered stomachs. We don't have, you know, we have canine teeth. We have incisors, and we have those for a reason. So I would make the argument that we're not supposed to be vegetarians. But I can also make the argument that in an ideal world, perhaps we could be vegetarians. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't live in an ideal world. So if somebody's a vegetarian or somebody's a vegan, I don't have a problem with that. But that has nothing to do with libertarianism, and it has nothing to do with zero aggression principle. If you begin applying the zero aggression principle to other animals other than humans, then you've leaped away from logic, and you're attempting to put the laws of humans onto animals. And this would work no better than if you attempted to use the laws of animals and place them on humans. So, you know, if I use animal the rights and the laws that govern lions, you know, then humans would pretty quickly rally together and do something about me, because the way lions live their life, if a human tried that, the rest of the humans would gang up on him and probably do to him what that flock of sparrows does to one of theirs. So, to try to bring this all together, it's just not logical to apply human rights to animals any more than it is, than we should apply the laws that it takes for a whale to survive in nature are entirely different than the laws that it takes for a snake to survive in nature. And the reason why is because these things have developed their own series of laws that are unique to their species, that keep their species alive and functioning and reproducing. And to apply the laws of one species onto another is unnatural and illogical. So for that reason, the whole argument of applying the zero aggression principle to animals falls apart. It has no basis in logic. It's not practical in any way. Now, you might be able to make the moral argument that, you know, we are attempting to better ourselves as a species. But the problem is you have to make a species leap to do that. You're going to have to step away from what humans are right now. And that can be an argument can be made in that direction. But we're not there right now. So I guess if you're going to make that argument that we're attempting to, you know, that you're a vegan or you're a vegetarian because you're attempting to set a higher standard for humanity, that's great. I appreciate you doing that. And I would support you doing that. Don't try to push it on me, though, because now you've violated the zero aggression principle when you try to push your morality onto me. So this is my opinion on how the zero aggression principle applies to animal rights and animal cruelty and so forth. Actually, I didn't touch on animal cruelty, so I'm going to break now, And when I come back from the break, I'm going to clarify my position on animal cruelty, because I'm against animal cruelty, and I strongly urge no one to be mean to an animal in front of me, because I can get pretty violent about that kind of a thing. I'll be right back. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Now, I should give a little bit of a disclaimer, and you might have if you're a long-time listener, you might have noticed that I'm a little off today. I'm not quite recovered from yesterday, so if I ramble a little too much or talk in a circle, that's why. Be patient with me, and I'll be better tomorrow than I was today. So, now on animal cruelty, I wanted to touch on this, realizing that the zero aggression principle applies to humans. There's nothing wrong with us saying, okay, I choose to not be cruel to animals. And being cruel to animals, expressing unnecessary cruelty, period, is something that a human should avoid. It's unnatural to us to be unnecessarily cruel. There's nothing in nature that would cause a human to be unnaturally cruel to an animal or to another human being. So we can apply the zero aggression principle in a sense, but realizing that it's not the zero aggression principle really only applies human to human. And if we choose to take a moral stand and not be cruel to an animal, it's because we're the kind of a person that would do that. And I mentioned a second ago, before the break, that I don't have much of a tolerance for people who are cruel to animals. And I tend to get a little violent if I see someone being cruel to an animal. And in that sense, I may be violating the zero aggression principle by getting rough with a human who's mean to their dog or whatever. I may be guilty of the zero aggression principle in that sense. I think, there's a biblical reference that says, to whom much is given, much is required. And I believe that. I think we as humans have at least a different level of intelligence, if not a higher level of intelligence, than all the other animals. And therefore, we should behave in a higher level than we see from animals. So, I was talking about cats, and cats will kill out of sport. They'll kill for the fun of it. And other animals will do that, too. Sharks are known to kill for sport, although not that often or not that much. Killer whales have been documented killing seals and playing with the dead bodies and tossing them back and forth like a beach ball. So there's cruelty in nature. What we would judge to be cruelty, there's cruelty in nature. But again, when we judge the killer whale for killing and then playing with a seal that he doesn't even bother eating, or when we judge a cat for, killing... I talked the other day about when Baggy caught her first mouse, and she was toying with it and playing with it and just having a blast with it, but she was, from the mouse's point of view, this was horrible. He was getting bit. This giant hairy monster is attacking him, batting at him, and carrying him around in her mouth. From the mouse's point of view, this is a pretty horrifying situation. But for Baggy, she was doing nothing evil. There was nothing evil at all to her as to what was happening. As a matter of fact, when I ran up and stabbed the mouse with a bayonet and hauled it away in the garbage, that was evil to her because I stole her property. So, but on the other hand, it's my house, and I can't have a mouse running around, even a wounded mouse that might get away from her. I can't have that in my house. So, in a way, it would have been nice if I could have just let Baggy play with her toy. And she was not guilty of any kind of cruelty, as horrible as it seemed to me that she was playing with this mouse like this. She wasn't guilty of anything evil. at the same time, I could have taken a more noble route in dealing with her and not killed the mouse right in front of her. I could have maybe distracted her and then killed the mouse. That would have been nicer of me. But I'm, according to the zero aggression principle, I'm under no obligation to treat Baggy in any particular way because she's not a human. And I'm under no obligation to treat the mouse in any particular way. But the fact that I care for Baggy and I feed her and I take care of her in different ways, I clean up her puke when she has a problem, I, you know, in the same way with the dogs that we have here, I'm kind to them because I choose to be. Not because I'm bound by any kind of natural law to be that way. Humans have found out through the ages that we get a certain amount of joy from interacting with animals. And that's strictly in the entertainment level. And if a person has it within them to be cruel to an animal, that's not necessarily a violation of the zero aggression principle. But it certainly reflects on what kind of a person that they are. Because whatever it is that's in the mind of a human that would cause them to be cruel to an animal, another human can look at that and say, that's not the kind of a person I want to be around. So take it back to the vegan or to the vegetarian. It's perfectly legitimate for them to say, yeah, I don't want to kill the, I don't want to have a cow killed so that I can have a steak. And if you choose that, that's great. And you can even say, I don't even want to be around somebody who would want to kill a cow just so they can have a steak. That's perfectly fine, too. Just don't try to push that on someone else. Like I said about animal cruelty, I'm not going to be all that good at controlling myself and following the zero aggression principle if I see somebody being cruel to an animal. But that maybe that's a flaw in me. Maybe I should respect the zero aggression principle more and not be upset when I see someone being cruel to an animal. I don't know. But, you know, at the same time, there is absolutely nothing in the zero aggression principle that requires a human to treat an animal in any particular way. The zero aggression principle is strictly a human law among humans and among our species and unique to us. It would be silly to try to apply the rules of humans onto animals. There's no need in it, and there's no logical foundation for it. Okay, so I actually took longer. I wanted to only spend one segment on that topic, but I ended up wasting half of another segment on it. The main thing I wanted to talk about today, and this is the thing that the podcast will be titled for. Although, I don't know, I've spent half of it now talking about animal rights. I suppose maybe I should mention that in the title as well. But the main thing I wanted to talk about today was this Robert Murphy video that's on YouTube. Bob Murphy is a brilliant economist and just a really cool guy. He's the guy, if you saw the Tom Woods video Interview with a Zombie, Bob Murphy is the guy that plays the zombie in that. Bob is a regular fixture at things like Pork Fest and stuff like that. He's probably, in ways, he's the goofiest of all the famous economists. He's the one most likely to have fun and really enjoy things like, for instance, he tends to go down to the karaoke bar and sing and do nightclub acts when all the students are down at the Ludwig von Mises Institute for the Mises University. He's quite entertaining, and he's a really, you know, fun individual. But he's also really, really smart. And so the folks over at Reddit put together a series of questions. He kind of challenged them and said, ask me anything. And so they put together a series of questions, and then Bob Murphy gets in front of the camera on YouTube and takes about an hour, I think it's like an hour and 10 minutes, hour and 15 minutes, something like that, and starts answering these questions from Reddit. And it's a really good video. I enjoyed it. If sitting for an hour and listening to an economist is not everyone's idea of enjoyment, But I like Bob Murphy, and I like listening to him, so I watched it and listened to it. One of the questions that struck me was they were asking Bob about NASA and about government-funded science projects, and specifically about, you know, things that NASA has accomplished. And the basic question was, without NASA, how would you have, you know, like X, Y, and Z? How would we have pens that write upside down if we didn't have NASA? And that wasn't mentioned in the video, the ink pens, but that was a thing from the 70s. For all of us old people that remember this, one of the big accomplishments of the space program was they had these wonderful ink pens that would defy gravity and write upside down. And, you know, NASA and whichever company it was that developed these were so... That was a big deal in the 70s. They have these pens that NASA can use that you can write in space with. They don't require gravity. The ink can flow upside down or anything. And then it was pointed out, yeah, the Russians have a thing they developed so that they could write in space, too. It's called a pencil. And you know, all the money that NASA worked through fascism, worked with this private company to develop an ink pen that could write in space, and the Russians are like, we have something like that. It's a pencil. And Bob didn't specifically mention that in the video, but to me, back in the 70s, that was even an example of how backward the thinking was, that NASA was accomplishing things. But in the question and in the video with Bob Murphy, you got to keep in mind that Bob's an economist, so he's answering the questions in the video based on economics. He's not addressing moral questions because that's not his job. The good economist is not going to say this should be done because it's good and that should not be done because it's evil. The good economist is going to say, this is the most economical way to do this, and this is not economical. Or this process over here will give you these results, but if you take this process over here, it'll give you these other results. The economist's position is not to judge which of those are moral or which are, you know, are better or good or whatever. The economist is just pointing out, you know, if you do A, B, and C, then the result will be D. He's not saying if D is good or bad. And this is something that a lot of people confused with, I had to pause the recording for a second, I couldn't remember his name, Milton Friedman. A lot of people talk about Milton Friedman and talk about, you know, they say he was a libertarian and so forth. No, he wasn't. He was never a libertarian. He might have called himself that at some time, but that doesn't mean he was. He adopted one libertarian position, and that was that the war against drugs was a bad idea. But you have to understand, and I've said this before about Milton Friedman, first off, he was a Chicago economist, which is based on Keynesian economics. So he was not an Austrian economist at all. And his only really libertarian position was that on the drug war, which that's not a libertarian position. Libertarian position is the zero aggression principle, and to believe that the drug war is bad is consistent with the zero aggression principle. But that's not how Milton Friedman came to his position on that. Milton Friedman looked at it from an economics point of view and said, this will not produce a good result. This will produce, you know, more people being drug users with more dangerous kinds of drugs, and a lot of money just sunk into this project with very, very poor results. So Milton Friedman was not making a moral judgment based on a moral principle like the zero aggression principle. He was making an economic judgment based on really well-known and clear economics that the drug war cannot accomplish what these people say that they want to accomplish. So therefore, it's illogical to follow that. That's not a libertarian position. That's just following logic. And so Bob Murphy, in talking about NASA, does not talk about this from an ethical point of view or from morals. He's talking about it strictly in the sense that, you know, are you going to accomplish what you think you're going to accomplish by dumping, you know, tons of money into NASA or any other, you know, government supported science program? Are you really going to get the kind of results that you think you're going to get? And Bob's answer is no, you're not. You're not going to get the kind of results you think. And the things that developed from the space program either would have developed one way or the other, or maybe something better. There's no way to tell exactly, you know, what things would be like right now had NASA not been involved. And to keep something in mind here, you know, the governments of the world decided back in the 1930s to shut down all private research that was being done in rocketry and in, you know, in space exploration. And all these things were shut down in the 30s and monopolized by governments. And they didn't allow private companies or private individuals to continue research in these things. So without any competition from the private sector, and with the government monopolizing any company that was involved in space exploration or rocketry or any of these things, then you can't speculate on what would or what would not be, considering that the government completely polluted the market for space exploration in the 1930s and maintained that all the way up to the present time, when you still, even though companies are attempting to get involved in, you know, in space topics of one kind or another, even now you have to have the government's permission, and you have to do this according to their rules and with the proper permits and everything. You can't just go out and, even no matter how much money you have, you can't just go out and start up a company and start sending rockets into space. The governments of the world will not let you do that. So even today, the market is polluted. So you can't judge it and say, well, would we have, you know, magic pins that write upside down or not? Well, there's no way of telling that, because the whole topic has been polluted by the government. So again, Bob is addressing this from a strictly economics point of view. From a moral point of view, if you think about the space program from a moral point of view, and you say, well, would we have X, Y, and Z if it weren't for NASA? Or would we have X, Y, and Z if it wasn't for all the money the government spent on science and pumping money into universities to support science? And maybe the giant collider over in Europe, would we have that if it weren't for all the government money? Well, the way you have to realize that, think about it a different way. Think about it like this. Al Capone. Here's a famous example for you. Al Capone was a huge fan of classical music, and he loved the opera, and he put a lot of money into bringing top level opera personalities to Chicago, and he put a lot of money into the music scene, so to speak, in Chicago. And at the same time, Al Capone was a big fan of jazz music. And now, at the time, in the late 20s, jazz music wasn't, I don't know how to say this without sounding bad, but it really wasn't something that white people typically liked. There was a lot of racial stigmatism involved with jazz music. And Al Capone just walked right across that racist border and embraced jazz music, and he did so very publicly. And in many ways, since Al Capone was a very well-known figure in Chicago at the time, and very respected by a lot of people, believe it or not, Al Capone was loved by a lot of people in Chicago, because he had not only embraced classical music and embraced the opera and was putting a lot of money into the opera and bringing in top-notch opera figures from Europe and so forth, but he was also embracing jazz music and supporting jazz music and putting money into clubs where jazz music was played. Now, by doing this, Al Capone kind of made it cool for a white person, an upper-class white person, to enjoy jazz music. Because prior to that in Chicago, if you were upper-class white, you were expected to look down your nose at those people who enjoyed that kind of music. And Al Capone broke that, broke through that wall, and broke through the racism, and embraced jazz music when nobody else, no other prominent figures in Chicago were doing that. Now, should we then assume that if it weren't for, Al Capone, then we wouldn't have the wonders of jazz music? should we say then that, you know, had Al Capone not been around robbing people, killing people, involved in prostitution, involved in all the things that we realized that the mafia was doing in Chicago in the late 1920s and early 1930s, you know, shaking down businesses for protection money, running different kind of rackets, all the things that the mafia was doing in Chicago, do we justify all of that because Al Capone helped jazz music? We say, well, yeah, I know he killed people, but hey, we got jazz music. You see? You see the leap away from logic that you take when you justify robbing people for something that other people want and then trying to look for something that's good that came out of it. I'm gonna break for a commercial, and then I'll be right back with the last segment of the show today. Folks, I want to talk to you about Survival Gear Bags. Survival Gear Bags is about more than just great gear bags and survival kits. Check out their website by clicking the banner at badquaker.com. Survival Gear Bags has everything from Wise food storage products to tactical equipment to camping supplies to clothing and rain gear to hydration and purification systems to books and DVDs. Plus, Survival Gear Bags is known for its service, and it's owned and operated by people who understand and adhere to the zero aggression principle. So get over to Survival Gear Bags and get the stuff you need. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. Let's get back to Al Capone. I want to pick on Al Capone a little bit more here. Al Capone was a close personal friend with Jack Dempsey, the boxer. He didn't make it really obvious that he was such close friends with Jack Dempsey. He didn't make that really clear and obvious because Al Capone was he didn't want to make it appear as though he was influencing the outcome of boxing matches. Had people got the impression that Al Capone was really, you know, friendly with Jack Dempsey, they might have got the impression that he was fixing fights in favor of Jack Dempsey. So for that reason, there was a financial, there would be a financial loss if people thought Al Capone was fixing Jack Dempsey fights. So he kept his friendship with Jack Dempsey fairly quiet, not at all like what I was talking about with the jazz. He would, he very publicly embraced jazz music, Al Capone did, but he kept his relationship with Jack Dempsey a lot more quiet because it could have negatively impacted the entire boxing industry. That's the kind of influence that, if people... And boxing has had, over the years, it has kind of had a bad reputation for, for influence by mobsters anyway. So it really wouldn't take much to verify to people that, and boxing, there's so much of boxing that's arbitrary. It's really obvious when you see a guy get knocked out, then you can say, all right, well, he lost. But so many of boxing matches can be really, really close, and they're judged by the judging system of boxing is really questionable at best. And if it had been obvious, then it could have really cost Al Capone a lot of money. And not only Al Capone, but the other mobsters who were actively involved in fixing fights, it would have been more obvious. So for that reason, he tried to keep it quiet. Now, that didn't mean that the fights weren't being fixed. Just because Al Capone wasn't obvious with his relationship with Jack Dempsey, that didn't mean the fights weren't being fixed. That didn't mean that they were being fixed. You can't judge it one way or the other just based on that. And again, taking this back to the NASA question, so would there be, space blankets or, Laffy Taffy or something if it wasn't for NASA? Well, again, there's no way to tell. I'll tell you what, let's look at it this way. Let's pretend, let's think of a bank. You have a bank, and a bank robber comes walking into the bank, and the first thing he does is he shoots the bank president. As soon as he walks in, the bank president is standing right there, shoots and kills the bank president. He shoots the first teller he sees and seriously injures that teller, and starts giving commands, telling the other tellers to get the money, get the boxes out, and let's get the money put together. Well, it just so happens that the vice president of that bank is a concealed carry owner and is in a perfect position to draw and fire on the bank robber and kill the bank robber on the spot. Now, at this point, the vice president of the bank takes command of the situation. He gets one of the bank tellers to the front door to make sure that no more customers come into this scene, and so secure the front door and prepare for the police to show up. So one of the tellers is stationed at the front door to not let any new customers in and to open the door when the police get there. And he gets control of the scene where the shooting has taken place. He makes sure that the bank robber is in fact dead, and kicks the guy's gun away from him so that just in case he's not dead, he can't wake up and grab the gun. He goes to check on the teller that's been shot. He finds that she's bleeding profusely. He grabs another teller there, shows her how to put direct pressure on the wound, and they start grabbing some material to try to control the bleeding with, and he just takes command of the whole situation. And through this act of leadership, he stabilizes this horrible setting in this bank robbery, and the police show up and everything. Now, we advance our story for weeks ahead, and things are getting back to normal in the bank. And the vice president has now been promoted, and he's now the manager, the branch manager. He's now the president of that branch. So then, would it be logical for him to say that what the bank robber did by coming in and shooting the bank president was good because now he is the president? See, you can't look at the end result and justify the aggression that took place. So, bringing the question back to NASA, the existence of NASA means that the United States government robbed people, stole from them massive amounts of wealth. During the 1960s, the quantity of money that was being stolen and given to NASA as a part of the as a percentage of the economy was massive. Compared to, if you do the math and bring that out into today's economy, the amount of money that the government was extracting out of the economy and shoving into NASA was an amazing amount of money. Now, you can say, well, it created jobs. Well, you're talking about the broken window fallacy. When you say that the government is justified in stealing money from some people and giving it to the others, well, then you accept this idea that, if you carry it out from an economics point of view, then you justify having people dig ditches and then fill them back in again. If all you're doing is giving people jobs, then you're like Napoleon, just digging ditches and having them refill it again and saying, look, we have 100% employment. But you're stealing that money from somebody else to do that with. So that means that money is not being used in a more productive way by the legitimate owner of that money. Maybe he would want to dig ditches and fill them back in. Maybe he wouldn't. Maybe he'd want to hire an equal number of people to work his fields and grow something or build something or do something productive. But instead, the government steals the money, pays people to dig a ditch, and then pays people to fill it back in. Now, in the process of this, what if something productive happens? What if, while they're digging the ditch, somebody bumps into a nugget of gold? Well, you don't pat the government on the back and say, without the theft and the aggression and the backwards economic activity of digging a ditch and filling it back in, without that, you'd have never found that lump of gold. Well, that's not a legitimate economical way to look at the argument. Maybe you would, or maybe you wouldn't have. But it's backward thinking to attribute it that. Now, let's take NASA in the 1960s. There's no way of knowing how business would have spent all that money and how individuals would have spent all that money if the government had not robbed them. Would there have been space travel? Well, first off, the government would have had to have backed out of that as well, and allowed individuals, you know, to research things like rocketry and space exploration. So if you back the government out of the argument entirely, going all the way back to the 1930s, keep in mind, in the 1930s, the government took control of all, and not just the United States government, the German government did this, the English government did this, the French government, the Italian government. They all took control of all research that was going on in the very, very, very infant industry of computers in the 1930s. The governments took control of those because the governments could see that having a very good computer would allow, for instance, a naval ship to be able to aim its guns better, or would allow an aircraft to be able to drop bombs more efficiently. And so because of this, the governments of the world grabbed that entire computer industry, and they did the same thing with rocketry. The governments saw these guys that were, you know, they were independent researchers that were playing around with rocketry in the 1930s, and the governments grabbed that and wouldn't let the free market do with it whatever the free market could have done. Now, you can imagine, let's say in the 1800s, if the governments of the world would have looked at something like Edison's inventions and said, look at that, a light bulb. Well, that can't be allowed. That kind of research can't be allowed out in the public. We need to get control of that because we can use this light bulb for war. Well, that's the way, of course, the governments of the world weren't mature enough at the time to do that, fortunately. But in the 1930s, they were mature enough to grab the industries of computers and rocketry. And because of that, we don't know where the industries of computers and rocketry would have gone if it weren't for that interference by the government. And you can think about it with computers. So the first thing the government does with computers is locks it down and only allows research to be done, you know, according to the funding that the government gives, according to the groups that the government chooses to give the funding to, and only to research the specific topic of how to aim guns and drop bombs. So that's the direction all computer research went from the mid-1930s until well up into the 1940s. And so, you know, how bad? That's 10 years of retarding an industry and not allowing it to develop naturally. And even after World War II, when the governments, they slacked off a little bit on the computer industry, and they allowed some choice businesses to begin using computers up into the 1950s, even then, the primary use for computers that the government could see was to aim bombs, was to control the flight of rockets, specifically for the purpose of killing people, because that's the way a government thinks. So all those years went by from the 1930s all the way up into the early 1970s that computers were only used either in a very narrow segment that the government allowed in business, or for the purpose of killing. That's the only purpose. That's the only reason the government could think of for these computers. Well, now, if you think of space travel, you think of this whole space industry and everything that was involved with NASA, what was the government's purpose in all that? Well, really and truly, and I don't think anybody hides this fact nowadays, but really and truly, the whole purpose in getting to the moon was to prove to the Russians that we had a better rocketry system than they had. It was a matter of intimidation to show the Russians that the United States had a more advanced rocketry capability, and was strictly to show the Russians up and to intimidate the Russians and to humiliate them on a worldwide scene. That was the whole purpose of the space program and the whole purpose of getting to the moon. So is that productive? Now, sure, somebody may have bumped into a nugget of gold while they were digging that ditch, but that's secondary to the purpose. The government didn't have, you know, talking back about Napoleon didn't have the guys out there digging ditches and refilling them so that he could find some gold. He did it because he was afraid of unemployment, and he was afraid of having his soldiers unemployed, and he had no imagination to think, hey, you know, if they're not employed as soldiers, they might go out and get a real job and become productive. He didn't think that far because he, as a military person in government, he could only think about a couple of things, which included, you know, having his military kill people. So he didn't think those in that direction. And it's the same way with the government people that controlled NASA. The purpose was to intimidate the Russians and to do something that they couldn't do or do something that they hadn't done. It was not for the purpose of inventing new kinds of plastic or, you know, ink pens that write upside down or space blankets that you can carry in your glove box of your car. All those things were secondary. And would they have developed? Who knows? But we can tell this, and this is what Bob was talking about in that video. We can tell this thing: whatever that the private sector would have used that money for, it would have been far more efficient and far better in the long run, because government money always pollutes the argument and never produces a good thing. This is the argument of Bastiat when he talks about that which is seen and that which is not seen. The government dumps a bunch of money into something for the purpose, you know, that of that which is seen. It wants to produce a specific result. But what is not seen and what is not planned for is all the consequences of that action. And those consequences, any time the government takes an action like that, the negative consequences always outweigh the positive consequences. Now, from a moral point of view, this is not a stretch. You can see this pretty clearly, because what is it that we're really doing here? We're robbing from one group of people and giving it to another group of people. Well, how can that possibly produce a long-term good result? It can't. On a moral basis, it can't. But what Bob Murphy is pointing out in this video is that from an economics point of view, you set the morals aside, from an economics point of view, it's not going to produce a good. In the long run, it will always do more damage than good. And you can't look at it in an aftermath and cherry pick the things that you like that came out of it and say, see, this is why it's good. We wouldn't have X, Y, and Z without, you know, robbing all these people and dumping the money into NASA. Well, that's backward thinking. That's like saying, you know, it's good that Al Capone robbed people and killed people and ran a crime gang, because otherwise we wouldn't have jazz music, and then rock and roll wouldn't have developed, and then we wouldn't have had the Beatles, or we wouldn't have had, you know, whatever. So it's backwards thinking to look at, to cherry pick positive results of the government's dumping money into the space program or dumping money into any particular science program. The money that the governments rob from productive people and then shove into one particular segment of the economy, it may produce some good things in that segment, but the overall balance is going to produce more bad than good. And it, you know, from an economics point of view, this is basic stuff, and you can observe it, you know, very clearly, and that's what Bastiat was talking about in his example. But also from a moral point of view, which is what Bob couldn't really address, being an economist, from a moral point of view, you're never going to produce a net positive result from robbing people and doing evil things and then doing some good things with a little bit of it, you know, or by chance some good things happened. Therefore, it justifies, you know, the robbery as a whole. Okay, now, so at badquaker.com, you can go over there, and I'll put a link to Bob's video on YouTube. Like I say, it's a little over an hour long, and if you enjoy that kind of thing, I enjoyed watching Bob's video, but it'll be there for you. And if you noticed on badquaker.com, we have added links to Amazon. So if you follow the links from Amazon and you buy anything at Amazon using those links, then a little bit of that, and it doesn't add to your price, but Amazon will share a little bit of that money with badquaker.com and help pay for the site and so forth like this. So that's a way that you can support badquaker.com, is by actually clicking on the Amazon links and then buying something that you would buy, you know, either way. So if you're going to buy if you're going to buy a bicycle helmet, then click on the link at badquaker.com and go over to Amazon and buy your bicycle helmet. It won't cost you one penny more, but a few pennies will go to badquaker.com. So that's my little commercial for Amazon and for badquaker.com. Folks, thank you very much for listening. So for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And again, thank you for listening. Bye, folks.